Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. At 10:20 p.m. on August 15, 1969, Ravi Shankar, then and still the most famous practitioner of the sitar in Indian classical music, takes the stage at Woodstock. It's arguably the zenith of Indian music's popularity in the West, with musicians like the Beatles, the Byrds, and Led Zeppelin embracing elements of Indian music. But this was merely the middle point of Shankar's artistic development, nor was it a personal highlight for him in a long and storied career. For many musicians in several different genres, both in and outside of India, Shankar is the most important messenger for the ideas and concepts of Indian music. Indian Sun, The Life and Music of Ravi Shankar by Oliver Krask is the first full biography on Shankar's life, charting his musical journey, from accompanying his older brother, the dancer Uday Shankar, on world tours at a young age, through the height of his worldwide acclaim in the late 60s, to the end of his life as the most respected performer of Indian classical music. Oliver Krask is a writer and editor with a long-standing interest in Indian music. He first met Ravi Shankar in 94 and worked with Shankar on his autobiography. Krask is also the author of Rock Faces, the world's top rock and roll photographers and their greatest images, a survey of leading music photographers. Today, Oliver and I talk about the life of Ravi Shankar and the many ways his music was important both in and outside of India throughout the 20th century. We'll talk about the fundamentals of Indian classical music, and whether India's music plays an important role in the country's cultural soft power. So, Oliver, thank you so much for joining me today. I thought if you could start by explaining the fundamentals of the Indian classical music that Ravi Shankar played, and how it differs from the traditional elements of Western music.
Thank you, Nicholas, and thanks so much for asking me onto the podcast. Indian music, it does differ in many ways from Western music, and I think that this has been one of the things that has both made it difficult for people from other societies, Western societies, but also given a great appeal to Indian music. I think without wanting to be overly technical musicologically, what you have obviously is a range of different instrumentation. The instrument that Ravi Shankar was most famous for was the sitar, which is it's technically a long necked lute with 19 strings and movable frets and all kinds of features that make it give it its very distinctive sound. We have the tabla drums, the most famous accompanying drums, which is a two piece drum. And we have usually a drone played by the tanpura in the background. That would be the typical lineup for a Ravi Shankar recital. So what you find automatically is there's a real emphasis on solo playing in Indian music over the orchestral or ensemble. And the music itself, we have an emphasis on solo melody lines. Playing improvisation rather than composition. There's all these very different aspects of music. And something that he often talked about himself was that the emphasis is on melody and rhythm in the music and not on harmony. And this is something that's perhaps the most alien thing about Indian music in many ways, is we're so used to harmony in Western music. But you have almost none in classical Indian music. These are all things that, you know, we can explore through Ravi Shankar's own work. What ultimately he did, he's most famous for a lot of people with what he did in presenting Indian music to the West and often people talk about his collaborations with Western artists. But I think what's really, really striking about him is how he kind of held to the fundamentals of Indian music. I mean, everything he wrote was in these two Indian concepts of ragas and talas. And I don't know if you want me to go into those now.
Well, it might be good to kind of go into a little bit about what these things are.
Yeah. So it's really striking that, you know, we're used to the idea of artists fusing, you know, playing fusion and bringing two traditions together and sort of to create a third tradition. But really, most of the time, he was playing Indian music. He was just using different instruments. And he was playing in these melody forms. A raga is a very precise melody form, which dictates, for example, the kind of patterns you can play a melody in as you go up or down the scale. And they use many, many different scales, not just the Western major and minor. And they're very, very distinctive. They kind of have a kind of feel to each raga. They're often associated with times of day or sometimes seasons of the year. And there's a kind of, yeah, there's a sort of feeling to them. They might be, one might be particularly playful or meditative or even erotic or, you know, this kind of, there's a different feel to every raga. And so everything he wrote would either be composed or more often improvised within one of these raga forms. And then the second concept is tala, which is the concept of rhythm. Indian classical music, you have, everything is based around rhythmic cycles. Once the rhythm comes in, and they're based on these really very technically advanced rhythmic cycles called talas. The most common would be a 16-beat one called tintal. And you find that the rhythm, the cycle repeats throughout a piece. It's rather like 4-4 music. It would be the most the closest comparator, tintal. But it's more complex than 4-4. And then there are all kinds of other ones. And Ravi Shankar, one of the things he became famous for was playing really complex rhythmic cycles like, I don't know, 11 or 13 or 11 and a half beats or, so there's this wonderful complexity in that, which he was really brilliant at himself. So that's a rather long introduction to Indian music from a technical point of view, but hopefully highlighting some of the ways it's rather different from Western music, that emphasis especially on melody and rhythm in the music and solo works over harmony and rather than orchestras and harmonies and ensembles and so on. But we should come back to that because Ravi Shankar actually did work in ensembles that was rather radical, actually, in Indian music.
Well, maybe let's get into that a little bit. I mean, so you mentioned that Ravi Shankar is perhaps most well-known outside of India, unsurprisingly, for his work outside of India, working with and influencing various Western musicians.
Yeah.
But before we get into that, and there's a lot to talk about in that, how important is Ravi Shankar to the development of Indian music in India, in the Indian context?
Well, I think he is. I think he's actually rather undervalued in that the contribution he made, not least in India itself. One of the themes of my book, Indian Sun, which partly inspires the title, is that, you know, we shouldn't forget that, this is, yes, he was an amazing global musician, but he was at heart very much an Indian musician. He did, I mean, there are many different aspects. I touched on his work on ensembles and orchestration. That was really almost unknown in Indian music. And he did start doing that in the 50s. Well, even earlier, actually, through film schools, but especially in the 50s. He started, it was a real passion of his to sort of explore orchestration. But going back a bit further, he learned from a very traditional and very great guru, Alauddin Khan, starting in the late 30s, late 1930s. He learnt Indian music, he learnt sitar. His instrument was sitar, but his guru was actually not a sitarist, but he learnt the music from him. And even from there, his guru was very influential in kind of synthesizing different traditions within Indian music. And so the form of a concert that Ravi Shankar would play, which has now become very, very, really what we think of as an Indian music concert. It starts with a slow meditative alap section, Then a pulse is added, and then rhythm is added, and it gets more and more exciting. It goes through these phases called jaw and jala. And then you end up with these improvisations on a section called gut. So there's these different sections, and they actually are like a synthesis from different places, from different traditions in India. So that's actually really, really important. I think it's not really appreciated that what he and also his fellow student, his fellow disciple of Alauddin Khan, Ali Akbar Khan, who was the son of Alauddin Khan, those two of them really did so much to kind of promote this kind of structure of a music recital, and I think that's underappreciated. It really came out of that it was like a new synthesis that was happening in the 30s and the 40s. So the very structure of the concert, and then there are also elements like the kind of professionalism that Ravi Shankar brought, which I think is really important. He was a real he was a master of stagecraft and presentation, which he got actually from his years in the dance troupe, which you mentioned in the intro. And I think that's really important at a time when, there was actually not a very long tradition of public concerts in India. And I think that it was really, really striking. People in India really noticed this, that this was you went to a Ravi Shankar concert, it was a real event, and he just did it by creating a kind of reverence for the music. It's not like pyrotechnic shows or something. It's really, just creating the right sort of atmosphere of respect. And he would always have incense burning at the side of the stage. He'd have a simple backdrop. And there would be a beautiful carpet on the stage. The musicians would all sit on the carpet. There would be a kind of, a lot of thought went into that and suitable lighting. And he was also really rigorous with introducing kind of professionalism to audiences in India, because, as I said, there wasn't that much of a tradition of live concerts. And, he insisted on, fixed start times and closing the door at the start of a concert because, to this day, you'll still find it. People will wander in and out of Indian recitals. And it's, it all sort of tends to undermine the kind of atmosphere a bit. So there's all these different ways that I think was really important, And then the one I haven't mentioned yet is actually when in the 50s, when he was director of music at All India Radio, he was a great gatekeeper for Indian music and musicians at a time when radio was really new in India. And it was doing the job of introducing all of India to its classical music. Which was very regionally based beforehand. And in particular, there's a big divide between North and South India where they're actually separate systems. But he was really important in promoting not only his own music, but all other, loads and loads of other musicians on the public stage, on the broadcast, on the radio waves. So there's all these ways that he kind of, I think, is the most important figure in creating a kind of modern music, classical music culture in India in the 20th century.
Yes, I was going to note that one of the common themes throughout the biography is Ravi Shankar gently chastising his audiences, whether they were in India or in the West. Another thing that's common throughout the whole book is Shankar's basically seemingly constant touring, and this gets into, I think, the interaction between his music and Western music. And there's a lot of different areas where there is this interaction. But I guess could you summarize some of the key ways that Indian music and Western music interacted throughout Shankar's life?
Yeah, I mean, there was a kind of prehistory of connections between, India and the rest of the world, musical connections. But broadly speaking, the West didn't know very much before about it. So I think when he started touring internationally, which was the mid-50s, he had a long tour in 1956-57 when he was based in London and then in New York. And so he was touring Europe and America. Really, it was something rather revelatory to all kinds of audiences. I mean, early on, you find his biggest fans tend to be jazz musicians in America. and also classical musicians. They're the first to really pick up. And from those earliest encounters, they start being influenced by what they're hearing because it's new. And as I talked at the beginning of all these different aspects of the music. So you start finding those influences, particularly, for example, the use of drones. People like Lamont Young, who very early on picked up on, this rather alien sound, what was alien at the time to Western music, except for in folk music. So aspects like that become really exciting. And then the kind of modal structure of Indian music where you don't change key, you stay on the same on the same tonic note throughout a piece. So things like that, you know, I think just really appealed. But then you find it also starts cropping up in pop music in the mid-60s, the influence, folk music as well. And I would argue, you know, it's actually a really significant moment when Western societies in particular are starting to be exposed to music of other cultures from around the world. And, you know, there's this sort of opening up of people's minds and ears. And I think he's incredibly important in that process, you know, that really has led to what is the musical world of today.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I think we can't talk about Shankar's relationships with Western musicians without mentioning George Harrison of the Beatles. And one thing that's clear in your biography is that this truly is a very deep personal friendship. I wonder if you can talk a bit more about that relationship.
Yeah, it was a very genuine friendship and a musical friendship, and it was lifelong. George Harrison starts to become interested in Indian music suddenly in 1965. It's actually when he was on the set of the movie Help, and there's a rather sort of cringeworthy scene in an Indian restaurant where there's a bunch of musicians supposedly playing Indian music, they're not. And in fact, the only instrument there is a sitar. But he on the set, he picked it up and he became rather fascinated by it. And then along with a lot of people, it just became an obsession with him. That year, he starts trying to listen to as much as possible. And you know, he very quickly comes across the name of Ravi Shankar, who by 1965 had been touring in the West for 9 years, and he's very much the leading representative of Indian music. I mean, he was already playing major concert halls by the late 50s. He was appearing on television and radio and, getting rave reviews in national newspapers. And so it's no accident that it's Ravi Shankar who's the person that he picks up on, because he was the leading representative. I mean, there were others, but he was the number one. And they meet eventually a year later in the summer of 1966 at a dinner party in North London that had been arranged specifically to introduce them. By this time, you know, the Beatles have already recorded Norwegian Wood. They've recorded Love You Too. So the first couple of their songs that have a clear Indian influence on them, and Tomorrow Never Knows, of course. But after that, you know, Ravi Shankar starts giving George sitar lessons. They become great friends. George goes out to India for 6 weeks in late 1966 to learn from him, which is just before the Beatles start recording Sgt. Pepper. And there's this enormous fascination with Indian music and Ravi Shankar. And, you know, he goes from being successful classical artist to being a real sort of a phenomenon, a superstar. And it's the connection with George Harrison that gives it that extra, that sort of massive boost, gives him that massive boost. So you get this, you know, phenomenon where by 1967 he's playing this incredible show at Monterey Pop Festival. He's Billboard Artist of the Year. He's, you know, and Indian culture is everywhere, you know, not only in pop music, but especially in pop music where all the musicians seem to be wearing Indian clothes. So, you know, I mean, all these aspects of Indian culture are suddenly very, very fashionable. And it's a really, when you think about it, it's a really remarkable moment. I think it's hard to think of a sort of comparable moment in pop culture when the music of one culture is completely mainstreamed into the pop culture of the West. So he becomes very famous. Their friendship is very important, but they don't actually start recording together until 1971, really. That's the jumping ahead. They play the concert for Bangladesh that year. They were the co-organizers of that great first charity concert in 1971, and George is tremendously helpful for Ravi's career. He helps Ravi finish a documentary movie that he'd made called Raga. He enables a couple of albums to be made in 1973 and 74 with Ravi Shankar and a sort of wonderful collection of musicians. That's Shankar Family and Friends and the Music Festival from India. And so there's a sort of series of projects they do together in that period, culminating with a tour of a sort of stadium tour of the USA in late 74. With Ravi Shankar and a bunch of Indian musicians being part of really what's like a kind of review or variety bill of a George Harrison concert, which I think there's a lot going on in that. But it certainly, you know, signifies something amazing that he's playing to these concert, these sort of great stadium shows and so on. And I think that sort of marks a kind of high water mark, and they kind of finish that tour a bit exhausted, neither of them really wanting to do that again. But their friendship continued, and they, you know, they constantly saw each other over the years. They returned to recording together in the 80s and the 90s. There's a wonderful album from 97 called Chants of India that George produced. And that's a lovely sort of return, a musical return of their collaboration. The friendship was there all along, right up until George's death in 2001.
So what were Ravi Shankar's feelings about these kinds of musical interaction and collaborations, not just with people like George Harrison, but also with Western classical musicians like Yuri Menuhin or Western classical composers like Philip Glass? The book notes several points where he seems a bit uncomfortable with these connections or attempts to fuse Western and Indian forms, though he does seem to become more comfortable with them as he ages, as time goes on. And as you've noted, he does kind of innovate in terms of bringing Indian music into ensemble work. So I guess kind of what were Shankar's kind of overall feelings about these sorts of musical connections, musical interactions?
I think the main thing was he was very excited by them, and you know he was you know, as well as being a wonderful performer, and you know he was a very fine composer, and he liked to explore the boundaries, you know, I think he was really excited to be, you know, working with them. But I think what's really striking as well is that in the collaborations he's playing Indian music basically. He might be playing along with Yehudi Menuhin, but Menuhin Menuhin's playing Indian music. Ravi isn't trying to play Bartok or, you know, some other Western classical music. And similarly, when he writes sitar for a concerto for sitar and orchestra in 1971, the first of three that he wrote, he's really using the orchestra to play Indian music. So, you know, I talk about him wanting to push the boundaries, but he sort of sets his own boundaries within that. He's a real proselytizer for Indian music. That's his main thing. And then he just loves exploring it with these other musicians and people like Menuhin and Philip Glass and George Harrison, Zubin Mehta, the conductor. I think that's his main feeling. But I think that what happened, you know, he also had this discomfort that you talk about. I think that's more to do with when he felt that Indian music was getting misrepresented or Indian culture was getting misrepresented. I don't think it's really about the collaborations that he embarked on. I think it's, you know, it, particularly in the late 60s, Indian music starts to become associated with drugs, for example. That was a big thing for him. He just didn't want that. That was not his approach. And he was very clear in telling his audience and his new students in the West that was, you know, the wrong approach to the music. And, you know, it just all goes a bit out of control, really. You know, this, you know, it's a massive, well, you know, Western fad for a few years. And I think that left him feeling uncomfortable he realized he couldn't control what people were saying about India. And he was getting this kind of flack back at home from people who were all too happy to kind of blame him for these misrepresentations that were going on. So I think that's where the discomfort arises from. And I think it is important, and it's important to understanding him, because, you know, he was really, really trying very hard to present Indian music, Indian classical music, in the correct light, and finding that it was being distorted was, you know, it was kind of torturing to him, really. And then, you know, I think that and he was a kind of, he could be a worrier as well. You know, he was a very charismatic, likable person, but I think that he spent a lot of time worrying about this kind of stuff, and kind of came to the conclusion, which was probably right, that was that he should not be playing places like Woodstock anymore, that he should go back to classical concert halls, and that was his core audience. And that's what he did, and he actually did it very successfully, you know, from the mid-70s onwards.
So you note that Ravi Shankar was a bit of a worrier. I mean, you got to meet him personally. What was he like in person? And did it differ from his public persona or stage presence or how the press might present him?
Yeah, I was very lucky. I spent a lot of time with him. First of all, as you mentioned, I worked with him on his, what was his last autobiography, as his editor. And then but after that, we maintained our relationship for the rest of his life, right up till he died in 2012. And I was lucky to get all this access. And he was he had a great warmth and a charisma around him. There was something of an aura about him, but it was not intimidating. It was just very, very impressive. He was attentive, and he kind of made you feel important. And also, he was a lot of fun. You know, there was a sort of playfulness to him that really comes across, I think, a lot in his public persona. I think his public persona is sort of, you know, it has different aspects. I think people recognize this kind of like serious kind of spiritual as well kind of figure. But then there's also this sort of great playfulness when you would see him in interview, or, you know, he had the most wonderful laugh that could, you know, lift your spirits. So I think he combined these different aspects, and I think that was really important to his success as well. You know, that he was great at relating to people. He had a, you know, he was likable, and you know, had this gift of communicating to a mass audience. He was very good at presentation, But he combined that with this sort of incredible deep knowledge and skill and feeling for music. And, you know, this is a great combination of skills to have, you know, and I think that is part of what explains why he was such a sort of groundbreaking, barrier-breaking person for Indian music, you know, rather than anyone else.
So I'd like to go a bit broader now in talking about Indian music. And I guess my question is, how important has Indian music been, and musicians like Ravi Shankar, to the idea of, you know, Indian quote-unquote soft power, to India's, you know, kind of acting as a cultural power, and yeah, so things like India's soft power. How important has Indian music and people like Ravi Shankar been to promoting that and supporting that?
I think it was very important in that period, especially after Indian independence. You know, the Indian government of the late 40s and the 50s, I think, understood this. I think, you know, Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, did quite a lot to set up support for artists. And, you know, that continued. I think there was an understanding that India didn't have the sort of hard power that, that some of the other countries did, you know, countries like America or Russia. And I think that they understood that they could gain influence by the example of their, for example, their artists and so on. And of course, the great figure in that was Gandhi, the Mahatma, who gave India this huge soft power. But it did continue, I think, in the attitude to artists. And I think Ravi Shankar is very, very important in that. You know, and that so many people from the 50s onwards would have experienced their first idea of India through him, or through Indian music, or through Indian dance, or maybe a film that had a score by Ravi Shankar, such as Patha Panchali, you know, the Opu trilogy of Satyajit Ray. He was at the center of so many of these, you know, sort of early encounters that people had. So I think it's very important. I think it's probably Indian music, classical music, is probably less important today. It's changed. I think these days probably Indian soft power is more exercised through, I don't know, cricket and Bollywood and so on. But it's still there. I think it's still really important. It's a representation of serious culture, a classical art form. I think it's important still.
Okay, so I think one final question before we wrap. If someone were to start exploring Ravi Shankar's repertoire, where should they start?
Well, it's a good question, because he worked across such a range of different music. Although, as I was saying, he stuck to Indian ragas and talas. There's you have the solo sitar works, you have Indian ensemble works, you've got Western orchestral works, you've got vocal music, the Chants of India, as I mentioned. You've got film music. He did a lot of work in the theatre as well, which I haven't talked about. He was great. He loved dance, and he loved writing music for Indian ballets and such like. So there's a lot there. Specific pieces I would talk about. I mean, there's a great album from 19... he recorded in 61 called Improvisations that has just a wonderful example of his solo sitar playing, plus about three other pieces in different styles, including the film score from Patha Panchali and a piece that he wrote for jazz musicians as well, American jazz musicians in Indian ragas and talas. So that's a good album. I love some of his later vocal works, like Shanti Mantra, Prabhuji, and Prashanti from the album he did with Philip Glass, Passages. So those are a few specific examples I'd recommend. I've done my own playlist connected with the book, which has more. It's got about 15 different tracks on it, which it's a Spotify playlist, which perhaps you can make that available on your show notes if that's of interest to you.
I most certainly will. So with that, Thank you for listening to our interview with Oliver Krask about his book, Indian Sun, The Life and Music of Ravi Shankar. Oliver, one actual last question.
Right.
Where can people find your work, and what's next for you?
The book is available. It's published in, at the moment, in English only, but it's available in India, in UK, America, you know, all over the world in English language outlets. The moment you'll mostly probably be ordering online because of the pandemic, but it's there. It's called Indian Sun, as I said. There's an audiobook of it as well. So I hope people will be keen to explore it. I don't actually know what I'm writing next. I'm working on some ideas. He's a very hard act to follow, Ravi Shankar. He had such a rich life. I was so closely connected to him that I've not quite found my subject yet, but I'm looking.
Well, I look forward to learning what your next subject is. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We hope you subscribe and continue listening to the Asian Review of Books podcast, now found on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, and share us with your friends if you want to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Dexter Roberts, author of The Myth of Chinese Capitalism, The Worker, The Factory, and The Future of the World. But before that, Oliver, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Nicholas. It's great to talk to you.